Welcome to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas. This evening, we again bring you Cryptic Delphic, Climate Conversation, and You've Been Served. And briefly, I wanted to wish all of our listeners a very happy holiday today. If you do celebrate Thanksgiving or Friendsgiving, because it is so important to appreciate every chance we have to break bread with the people who are nearest and dearest to us and to express our gratitude. However, I do not want to celebrate Thanksgiving as it is recounted in the U.S., and instead would like to wish everyone a happy Indigenous Peoples Day and dedicate this episode to the students of Indigenous origin here at AUP and to all our listeners to whom this applies. Your voices have too long been ignored, and finally we're starting to see some progress. Alone here at our university, our media organization testifies to this as we have students of Indigenous origin writing for our digital and print news publications and also participating in AUP Radio. So this is just to say, we hear you, we see you, and we want to fight this battle with you. All right, here's the show.
And welcome back to Cryptic Delphic with me, Mel, where we talk about all things horror, paranormal, conspiracy theories, and murder mystery. So, as always, quick disclaimer, this is a show for, like, mature audiences. We discuss about a lot of things that may make people uncomfortable, such as murder, cults, sexual assault, rape, etc. And if you feel like this isn't for you, then I recommend not tuning in. But if you really are an enthusiast of horror, then I recommend that you listen and tune in, because, well, we talk about a lot of fun things. So the first thing I want to talk about is La Pascualita. This is a Mexican horror story based on, like, a real urban legend, and you can actually visit La Pascualita today, to this day. So La Pascualita is basically the corpse bride. So for more than 80 years, people have been visiting this bridal gown shop in Chihuahua, Mexico, and they see that there's this mannequin who's wearing this really pretty, like, bridal gown, and people visit it because they claim that La Pascualita, the mannequin, they call it La Pascualita, is a corpse, and they believe that it was the daughter of the original owner. What happened was Pascuala Esparza had a daughter who was really beautiful. She was going to get married. And sadly, the day before her wedding, she got bit by a black widow spider and died tragically, like, sadly. And it's according to the legend, they say that the mother was super devastated. She wanted to keep her daughter with her forever. So she put her daughter in, like, this corpse type mannequin type statue and put it on display at the store. So that's, like, the legend. The original store owner claims that that's not true, that she would never do that. But people have gone to see the mannequin for themselves, and they say, like, oh, the nails look so real, the lashes look like they're so realistic. Everything about the mannequin is just super realistic. They also say that the Pascualita would just move on her own. It is said that a love-struck French magician would arrive at night and bring her to life and just take her out in town. Others say that she would just follow them around, like, she would just follow them around in the store, and she would change positions overnight. A shop owner, her name was Sonia Boriaga, she claims that she would change the mannequin's gowns twice a week. And she said, every time I go near Pascualita, my hands break out in a sweat. Her hands are very realistic, and she even has varicose veins on her legs. I believe she's a real person. So there is another legend that rolls around La Pascualita, and that is, if you are a bride-to-be, you have to go visit La Pascualita and she will grant you luck. Or if you are a woman that wants to find love, you go to her and ask for love and she will grant you love. So that's, like, a very sweet side story that, you know, brides can go do that. So yeah, it's a very spoken about story in Mexico. My mom would tell me about La Pascualita and this other story that I'm going to get into in just a moment. If you're ever in Chihuahua, Mexico, and you decide to go visit La Pascualita, she's still there today on display at the bridal gown shop. And it's, you know, your own take whether or not she's a corpse or she is a mannequin. It's all up to you. So the next story I'm going to be talking about is La Llorona, and this one is probably one of the most famous folklore stories in Mexico. Like, my mother would tell me this story. I've seen so many movies on La Llorona. And I think there was actually like a American movie, The Curse of La Llorona, that recently came out this year. I didn't see it, but I've heard mixed reviews. So La Llorona is said to haunt rivers and canals, and her story is actually very sad. But there are two stories that revolve around who she was. So the first story was, her name was Maria. She was born in a peasant family in a humble village. And it is said that she was so beautiful that her looks captured the attention of rich people to poor people to soldiers to, like, everyone, you know. So she was said that in the days she would just be very humble and just surround herself against, like, with her own people. But in the evenings she would just wear all these extravagant gowns and go out and thrill men who admired her, you know. So the young men would just anxiously wait for her to come into the, and she would just garner all this attention, and she loved that attention. However, Maria had two sons, and so it made it difficult for her to spend time with them on the evenings. So she would just let them, like, be alone while she was out and about with the gentlemen. So one day, the two small boys were found drowned in a river. Some say that they drowned on their own because it was just, like, neglect. They went out to play and they drowned. But others say that she may have killed, like, her own children and drowned them so she wouldn't have that responsibility anymore. Another legend that revolves around La Llorona, and this is the one that I was told as a child. I was told that La Llorona was a caring woman who was full of life and love, and she loved her family. She loved her two kids. And she married a very wealthy man who gave her all these gifts and attention, and she was very happy with that. And she was very happy with her family. However, after her sons kind of got older, he began to kind of change, and he started becoming an alcoholic, and he was just becoming very womanizing and would leave for months at a time, come back, and just be very different overall. So he seemed to no longer care about Maria, and he would even talk to her sometimes about leaving her for another woman or a younger woman. One day, he did return home only to find, only to find his children, like, very angry at him. And he decided, like, I'm just going to pay attention to my children only and just kind of not focus on Maria. And he started being very neglectful towards Maria, and she was very devastated at this. So one evening, Maria was out with her two children, and they were on a pathway near a river, and her husband came in a carriage, and in that carriage was a beautiful, like, woman who was much more younger, and Maria became very enraged. And what she did was, it is said that she threw her children in the river. When she realized, like, what she did out of anger, she ran down the river to get to her children, but it was too late. They died. And she started weeping and crying and just yelled out for her children. And over time, she would just, like, get more thinner and thinner because she wouldn't eat. Her dress became more tattered. She became taller. And she became more like a skeleton rather than a person. And she would just still be there yelling, like, oh, my children, like, I want my children back. And it is said that she died at that river yelling for her kids. So the story is that you will hear a wailing and weeping near a river, and you'll hear a woman calling out for her children. So children are said not to, like, go out at night because La Llorona might be there and confuse them for her own children and take them. She is also known as an omen of death for those who see her, and it is said that she will attack anyone or kill anyone that are adults and not children because it'll make her think of her husband. So a story behind this, Patricio Lugan, when he was a boy, he said that he and his family saw her on a creek between Mora and Guadalupita, New Mexico. As the family was sitting outside talking, they saw a tall, thin woman walking along the creek. She then seemed to float over the water, started up the hill, and vanished. However, just moments later, she reappeared much closer to them and then disappeared again. The family looked for footprints and they didn't find any, so they had no doubt that the woman they had seen was La Llorona. In Santa Fe, New Mexico, the tall, wailing spirit has been seen repeatedly by the Public Employees Retirement Association, and that land was actually built, like, on an old cemetery, and it's near the Santa Fe River. So people say, the people that work there say that they hear wailing, and they just hear, like, they believe it's like Llorona wailing for her kids, and they feel sometimes hands pushing them on the stairways, like pushing down against them, and it feels very cold at times, and they believe that it is the spirit of La Llorona. So yeah, just a very interesting folklore story. Whether or not you believe in that is up to your own interpretation. There are many countless documentaries, movies, even children's movies on La Llorona, and they're all really interesting, and I totally recommend them. It's just a very interesting folklore story, and it's very famous in Mexican culture, so it's just interesting. The next legend I'm going to be talking about is, we're moving away from Mexican stories to one from Alaska, and it is called the Kushtaka, and this is from the Tlingit people. They are a indigenous tribe in Alaska, and they believe that the Kushtaka, they are otters, and they take the form of a cute little otter so they don't seem harmful, but the second that they get you alone, they are shapeshifters, and they have evil purposes, and they trap their victims' souls and prevent them from reincarnating. So, as I mentioned, they're called the Kushtaka, but they are also known as the Kundaka. And it is said that when you're walking through a village or hunting in woods or fishing in the sea, a man or group of men approach you. And these men just look like regular men. They'll be fishermen, and you don't have a clue, like, where they're going. They'll tell you, like, oh, I'm injured, or oh, I'm lost, I need help, and you'll agree and go help them. And they will also claim sometimes that they'll rescue you and they'll help you find your way home. So they lure you deep into the wilderness or deep into just a very isolated place, and they'll just tear you to pieces and then turn you into a Kushtaka, like the shape-shifting otters, which prevents your soul from being able to reincarnate. And in this culture, reincarnation is very important. Reincarnation in general is just a very important idea of having a continuous life. So if you're not able to have that continuous life, it's seen as a very horrifying thing. So groups of Kushtaka are extremely dangerous. They claim that they might lure you towards them by screaming or making noises that sounds like women or children in distress. And then once they see you coming, you'll never be able to escape from them. And you're basically, like, screwed. You're done for it. The very cuteness of otters are what make Kushtaka so dangerous, because you're drawn to their playful nature, and it's just easy to miss the fact that these creatures want to consume our souls and just spend, like, an eternity wandering around the tundra. But there is actually one thing that can go against the Kushtaka, and that is dogs. There's a lot of dogs, like these giant furry dogs in Alaska. They are used during sledding. They're used for shipment purposes and also protection of villages. The Kushtaka are supposedly very terrified of dogs. Luckily, Alaska has plenty of these, like, of dogs, so villages feel very safe from harm. It is also said that fire can also prevent the Kushtaka from attacking, but people mostly say that it's the dogs that will protect you. So yeah, just a very interesting story. And I'm going to move away from Alaska now and head to Minnesota, where I'm going to talk about Vikings in Minnesota. So, I've always been fascinated by Viking, and the Norse mythology. I'm very fascinated with mythology in general, but Vikings have just been so interesting, especially with their language of the runes. And these runestones were, like, erected throughout the region between the 4th century AD and at the end of the Viking Age in 12th century AD. So they had these runestones, and it would have, like, different discussions of people or travel diaries type information. It was just, like, a bunch of information that scientists would find on these plaques, and they would be erected on land, and it would just explain what the Vikings did there, who the Vikings were, or involved in a project. So it is said that a lot of runestones today are in Sweden, others are in Denmark, some are in the British Isles, and some are in Ukraine as well. One of the most famous ones are the Kenningstone ruins. It was found in Kenningston, England, hence the name Kenningston runestones. However, the Kenningstone, there's another one, is in Minnesota, USA, and it's 2,000 miles away from Canada. The only place in the Western Hemisphere that is said to have had Vikings comes explore the Western Hemisphere during that time period. In 1898, Swedish immigrant Olof Åman announced that he discovered a type of sandstone while he was clearing the land near the town of Solon, Minnesota. So he brought the 200-plus-pound stone to nearby Kenningston, and the local bank put it on display. And they never really asked any questions. Some people sketched it out thinking it was beautiful, and it wasn't until it garnered the attention of scientists that the runic characters on the stone were sent to the University of Minnesota to be translated and properly studied. So that the translation, they pretty properly translated it, and it reads as follows. 8 Gotlanders and 22 Norwegians on reclaiming acquisition journey far west from Vinland. We had a camp by 2 shelters one day's journey north from this stone. We were fishing one day. After we came home, we found 10 men red with blood and death. Ave Maria, saved from evil, have 10 men by the sea to look after our ships. 14 days travel from the island, year 1362. So no one really knows what happened. It's very strange that the Vikings that created this runestone didn't know what happened to their men either. Some type of evil entity attacked them. We don't know to this day what happened. Many people claim that this is a true Scandinavian object. However, there are some skeptics that think that this is a fake object. That's just because, you know, it discusses about paranormal. It discusses about evil entity, and it discusses about like mystery. So they're just not sure if this is a real object and it should be taken seriously. But others believe that this is a true object that proves that Norwegian people actually, you know, before Columbus colonized in America, they believe that, oh, Scandinavian people may have found America first and explored a bit and then left. So no one really knows the truth. They don't know the truth about this runestone to be exact about if it's a true item or not. And they don't know if they were attacked, what had happened. But it's just a very interesting thing to keep in mind, because there's a lot that we don't know about the past and the culture. And we don't know if there were things back then that we just don't know about. Like, we never know. Maybe magic was more, you know, like, seen back then because there was less things to focus on. I don't know. Sometimes I think, and I have like this conspiracy theory in my head, that we are so focused on technology and problems and ourselves that we don't realize that the outside world has so many things. And back then there was no technology. There was just nothing that really people had to entertain themselves with. So I believe that magic and other things were more, it was just more visible to the eye because you were focused on nature and your surroundings, and you just didn't have so much things sucking out like your own power and entity and stuff. So I just personally believe that maybe back then, like, there were things that we just don't see today, or they just went extinct because there was just less things to focus on. There was just less things. So I don't know. Like, it's just my own little conspiracy theory. You either or not you believe in that, it's just up to you. But I don't know. Sometimes I think about these things and it keeps me up at night just thinking, what if? Like, what if? So I'm going to move on to Oklahoma. For those of you who don't know where Oklahoma is, it is a state between Kansas and Texas. And it is said that Oklahoma has its very own Bermuda Triangle. So this is in Beavers Dunes Lake Park. It is located in the panhandle of Oklahoma, and the dunes are home to a legend involving the Spanish colonizer Coronado. And so it is said that one night during a military excavation, that the colonizer, he traversed the area on his quest to discover New World gold. And the Native American the tribe that was there at the time warned him not to go to that area because there was a lot of danger there. They said that he had to keep away from the dunes. So the price he paid, basically, was that he had 3 people from his expedition suddenly vanish before his eyes. And he had an expedition diary, so this is how people today know this information. So he says that he saw lights, like green lights, in the sky before that they disappeared, and he called the phenomenon the work of the devil. So the natives called this the Shaman's Portal. The area has been blamed for numerous disappearances. None have been verified, and this has all been happening within the last century. However, locals have claimed the witness the mysterious evacuations were conducted under the cover of darkness, basically. So what does that mean? That means that people have gone to do research on this land. They claim that their rocks have some strange substance that they believe is alien. There have been multiple geologists from Oklahoma State University, one of them, Dr. Mark Thatcher, decided to do research on these rocks on the land because they claim that something very strange is there and they really just want to find out what it is. So one day they were doing this investigation and he claims that the men in black basically showed up, stopped them, and said, "You are no longer permitted here. We're taking over."
If you've just joined us, this is Cryptic Delphic on AUP Radio, brought to you by WRP. It's 9:20.
And, like, it's crazy to think, like, the men in black just, like, showed up and said, "No, you cannot no longer do this. We're taking over because something weird is going on here, and we don't want the public to know about this, and we don't want scientists to know about this. This is, like, only government." So, yeah, I found that very interesting because, personally, I do believe in the men in black, and I believe that the government is hiding a lot of things. Because if you, I don't know, the government has just been hiding a lot of things. They've been really saying things, and a lot of things are not true. This is a lot of suspicious things going on within the government. And I love the Men in Black movies. They're really funny. It's just so strange that the scientists really wanted to do research on this land that's caused so many disappearances, has actual material that is alien to us in their rocks, and they can actually figure out where it comes from, if it's alien or not, if it's radioactive. Maybe there's something really dangerous there that people need to know about to evacuate people within that town. But no, the government just shows up and says, "No, you cannot no longer do this." People also claim that flying saucers were also seen, and there may be one buried down there. That's a conspiracy theory, that there's a flying saucer buried there, and that's what causes the radioactive material to go onto these rocks. And there's also a fact that it may have been an ancient Native American burial ground, and there has been some things built around that area. And in Native American culture, it is very important to just leave the sacred lands alone, because, you know, that land's sacred, it's important, and it holds great significance in native culture. And if you put some structure there, a building, for instance, it is seen as bad, and bad omen or bad luck will come to you, basically. So they put buildings there, so it may cause, like, the disappearances, but that's just speculation. And whether or not you believe that, that's up to you. But there's just a lot of strange things going on in this area. People just have so many different conspiracies of aliens, of magic, of ritual, and there's been green lighting seen to this day. So if you're ever in Oklahoma, you just should go there and see on your own. Like, maybe it's something that can be explained scientifically, or maybe it is something paranormal, or like another dimension, like we discussed last week, of the fourth dimension. People get transported somewhere else in a world like our own, but it's a bit different. So you never know. I don't know. When I go to Oklahoma, I'll definitely have to go there and let you guys know what I find. So we're now going to be talking about the Candy Lady in Texas. When I was doing research on this case, I was very shocked by how insane this case is. So this is one of the creepiest, like, urban legends in the state of Texas itself. And it involves Clara Crane, and they called her the Candy Lady. And so Clara Crane, she was accused of poisoning her husband back in 1895. So what she did was she gave her husband these caramels, and she laced them with poison, gave them to her husband. The husband ate them, and he died. So people say that she killed her husband for the reason that their son died a few years back, and she believed that her husband killed her son. So she did it out of revenge. She murdered her husband with these poison-laced candies. And instead of going to jail, they placed her in the North Texas Lunatic Asylum. It's today known as the Terrell State Hospital. So while in the asylum, she made a doll out of torn bed sheets, and she called the doll Marcy, and it was the same name as the dead child. And she even wrote in a letter, Clara wrote this letter supposedly to her sister, discussing about the things that would happen to her in the asylum, and the adventures that she would have with Marcy. So this is one of a small portion of the letter. It says, "I am elated. I have been informed by Dr. Matthews that Marcy and I will be returning home. We'll be returning home in less than 3 weeks. As you can imagine, Marcy can barely contain her excitement. Every night she asks, is tomorrow the day when we can go home, Mother? Very soon, I will be able to tell her yes." So, nurses and other doctors at the asylum claim that Clara could be seen talking and singing to the doll. And in 1899, she was released from the hospital due to overcrowding. So, even though she allegedly committed the murder, she was fit for release. They claimed that she was, like, fine. She was healthy. She was just fit for release. And they released her. And right after she was released, she was never heard from again. She just completely disappeared, which is completely insane, because if you have a woman who is basically, she was basically claimed like she murdered someone, she was in an asylum, and you say, okay, we can release her, it's just insane to me that no one offered to like go out with her, put her in like some place where they can keep an eye on her, no police, just no one was with her, and she just disappeared. Like, that's so insane to me. Like, so like, that sounds so dangerous too. Like, that is so terrifying to me. And I don't know, I just feel like maybe this happens, but we just don't know about it because police don't want to make people panic. It's just insane to me. I don't know, it's just crazy. So now here is when things take a sudden twist. In 1903, children started going missing near her old property. So children said that candy would be left on their window while they were sleeping. Sometimes there would be notes on the wrappers around the candy. And it just really caused a complete panic with people. Like, their children started going missing. The townspeople, they knew about Clara. They knew about what she was doing, what she was capable of. They knew the whole story. The story basically went around. And so the townspeople really believed that it was Clara, the woman that killed her husband with poison candy. It was just very coincidental. A nearby farmer found teeth in the fields, and he called the sheriff. He told him, like, I found some teeth. Can you please investigate? Because I'm kind of worried that maybe Clara struck again. And so the town sheriff went, and he was actually killed. He had forks shoved into his eyes and was found with candy in his pockets. To this day, no one knows what really happened to Clara Crane. And it is believed that the candy lady still roams around, luring little children with candy, and then she'll pull out their teeth and stab their eyes with forks. Completely scary. It's just insane that she disappeared, and I wonder where her whereabouts are. I wonder what truly happened to Clara, and it's just sad that those children and that sheriff lost their lives. So yeah, this has been another episode of Cryptic Delphic. Once again, whether or not you believe in all these different stories is up to your own interpretation. I do not glorify murder. What happened is very tragic and horrific, and please be respectful when you're doing your own research on these different investigations and families, because these are real things and not made up. So yeah, I'll tune in next week again, and stay safe out there, guys.
Hello and welcome to Climate Conversation. This is Avani, and I'm joined here today with Elise, the deputy editor.
Hello, hello.
Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's a beautiful day. It's cloudy, but it's still very nice. Okay, so the climate crisis is pushing Earth towards a tipping point. This is something that we have covered multiple times, but, reiteration is important because we cannot stop the fight. Plans to cut carbon emissions from concerts. Basically, so scientists at the University of Manchester are creating a blueprint to help bands and pop stars to perform live and tour the world without contributing to climate change. This is something that's very important because as artists and pop stars tour not only just North America or wherever they're based, their flight emissions and their truck emissions and their bus emissions is really high. So it's really important to try to figure out how to make it more sustainable and carbon neutral. Mm. So it's really great that the University of Manchester is trying to help these bands do this.
So are they, have they given specifics as to how they're going to, or, you know, have they given indications to these fellow pop or pop stars, whoever it is, like how they can reduce their carbon footprint by taking like flights with other people, or?
I believe it's through carbon offsetting. So,
oh, okay.
You know, planting trees and changing the vehicles that they use, mm-hmm. and just, yeah, I think it's just
interesting
using the little things that we have right now. So Vermont, going back to the U.S., Vermont doubles down on wood burning. Essentially, wood burning is a consequence for climate and health. Essentially, wood is the cheapest and most common way to heat a home. I remember, you know, when I was young, anytime, mm-hmm. you know, winter rolled around, we'd either get the fire logs or we'd get mm-hmm. wood logs, and it was just super basic normal. And anytime we would go camping, we would also do the same thing. Mm-hmm. But little do we know, it's not clean energy, and wood smoke contains a diverse mix of pollutants that can harm people's health, such as carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, volatile organic compounds such as benzene and formaldehyde.
Formaldehyde, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's a copious amounts of sooty fine particles called black carbon that can penetrate deep into the lungs and cross into the bloodstream. So mm-hmm. it's both a health and climate issue. And mm-hmm. it's really important that we start moving away from wood burning. That being said, it's really fortunate that, you know, people in Vermont, even though it is cold, they have options to not use wood, although it is cheaper. But if you take into account Africa as a whole, they cook with wood stoves and with wood fires. And a lot of times, a lot of NGOs are trying to help these people move away from wood stoves and using fire just to power their cooking, as well as dung. But a lot of times it's so ingrained in their culture.
I was going to say, yeah, there's
that it's
that
really
whole
hard.
Element,
yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to move away from that, and it's also a lot cheaper, but mm-hmm. it's one of the mm-hmm. leading factors of deforestation as well, mm-hmm. As well as, you know, livestock mm-hmm. grazing. But it's really hard whenever you have to take into account their culture too.
Right.
Because we can't force them to do anything. Like,
no.
We can't be like, you need to stop doing that. Like, it's not our place to say that.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to try to figure out, like, a way to transition from mm-hmm. wood to something else. Vermont actually already produce about 22 pounds of particulate matter emissions per capita from wood burning each year, by far the highest in the nation. So it's really great that Vermont is doubling down on wood burning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm actually, so I spent quite a bit of time in Vermont, especially during my ski racing years, but
super sick.
Something that's really interesting is that, you know, their biggest industry, or one of their biggest industries, is maple syrup. You know,
that is
tapping
so
trees,
true, yes.
And they use all their sugar houses in order to get the best product possible. They do use wood, and they you know, they use fire. So I don't know. It also gives that kind of that kind of wood taste.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So it'll be really interesting to see how they kind of curb that. Because any sugar house I ever visited, the amount of smoke, it's a lot of steam actually. Mm. So it's not too bad. But I mean, you can look at some of these companies that, you know, burn plastic or burn trash, and the emissions are just absolutely wild.
Insane.
Whereas, as you said, you know, some of these things are cultural things. So it'll be really interesting to see how people change with time or kind of adapt.
Yeah. I think that's something that we as a people as a whole, like no matter where we're from, we really need to learn how to adapt to these changes. Mm-hmm. Because not only do we have to change our actions and our habits, but we also have to realize that the environment, because it's going to be changing so much due to our impact,
mm-hmm.
We can't necessarily go back to the way it used to be. We can try, but it's never going to be the same. And mm-hmm. we have to realize that we need to learn to adapt to these changes, learn to really understand why we can't go back to our past actions and to our past habits and to the way the environment used to be, but also be okay with that mm-hmm. and realize that, you know, change is also beautiful and we can have a lot of beauty with how we're going to change mm-hmm. in our actions and in the environment. So,
yeah. And I think hope is, you know, the driving force in all of this.
So. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. Next is Black Friday. Ooh. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Although we should not really celebrate Thanksgiving, let's say Friendsgiving. The history of Thanksgiving is an issue on its own. But Black Friday, we need to talk about this. I personally do not like Black Friday.
Not a fan.
It's super toxic. It's just, why do we have to buy so much? We're giving thanks on one day, and then literally that same day we start lining up to buy more stuff as if we don't.
Mass consumerism.
Consumerism, that whole toxic mentality. We consume so much plastic, and just through shopping consumption, it's really unhealthy for both our minds and also the climate. If you guys want to watch a documentary on just the actual cost of new clothing that is not upcycled or manufactured in a healthy way, there's a documentary called True Cost that is super, super, super good and really explicates just the real damages that fast fashion has. So just by going through Black Friday, that's one way that it also contributes to that, as well as just the huge environmental toll that we have through all the bags that we have.
It's insane. I mean, if you think about anything you purchase, even in the grocery store, even stores that, you know, claim to be conscious or whatever of plastic consumption, so many different products are wrapped in plastic.
Yeah. Individual plastic bags for bananas.
Right. Or cucumbers are usually wrapped. Yeah.
Yeah. Or avocados or beets. Mm-hmm. Not to mention just all of the spices that are sometimes in plastic containers or, I mean, it's everything.
It's
or even rice, like instant rice.
Yeah.
Like that's in a plastic bag.
Everything.
And that's not going to decompose at all. Like if you think about it, every single piece of plastic that we've made since the beginning of the time that we started making plastic is still in the landfill.
Right. And it's really interesting because this whole wave of, you know, plastic consumption or production or whatever is actually quite recent. If you think about it, I mean, you know, what, 150 years ago, they were not walking around the streets with plastic.
No, they were.
So I don't know. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I think it's because of the fact that we started moving more towards how to make our lives more easy and not spend so much time doing this or that, you know, having more stuff, making everything cheaper, that we tried our best to, you know, spend at the least amount of time doing this or that.
Right.
So we have pre-cut avocados in the market, and it's wrapped in plastic because they don't want it to go bad. And it's like, why don't you just use a knife and cut the avocado? Mm-hmm.
And then there's the whole idea of, you know, single-use plastics. Ugh. And I know that the EU Parliament did, because I did like a mini docu-series on this, but the EU Parliament passed a law banning, they're trying to ban single-use plastics by 2021, which is a great initiative. It's, you know, a lot of progress. But if you look at any of these, you know, big grocery stores, they're still handing out plastic. They're still heavily relying on plastic. So it's kind of, I don't know. I just feel like we've all become so reliant on plastic. You know, even after I'd even, you know, done this like mini docu-series and was very conscious of my consumption or
it's really hard to move away.
It's so difficult.
So hard. I agree. It's also really frustrating that the fact that like stores are saying, yeah, we're no longer using plastic bags, but they still sell them for like 10 cents.
Right.
And it's honestly like a scapegoat. They're just greenwashing it. They're just saying, okay, we're not, you know, giving plastic bags for free, but you can still buy it for a super, super, super cheap price.
Right.
And it's fine. Mm-hmm. So honestly, we really need to start investing in cloth bags, reusable bags for even just our grains, you know? Whenever you want rice, you can just get it in bulk and use a reusable bag to put it in. And that's just one way to...
And I heard an interesting argument because I was talking to someone. I was, you know, the same thing. I said, well, why aren't we using, you know, reusable bags or those cotton bags or whatever? Because I have a few of them and all of mine are still in really good shape. And someone tried to argue with me and said, well, that takes so much longer to decompose than plastic. It's so much more polluting. I don't know. Some people, it was just.
I don't understand this because, like, it can last years.
Oh, yeah. I've had some that have literally lasted, you know, 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, my bags that I've had so far, I have had them for like 5-6 years right now, and they're still like in perfect condition.
Right, right.
And I don't see myself buying anything new for the next, I don't know, 20 years maybe.
And also this whole, because you touched on this topic, but fast fashion, I think that some of those companies are definitely slowing down. I mean, Forever 21, they're shut down. Yeah.
Did they really? Oh, I hadn't heard
they
that.
Didn't they file for bankruptcy? I'm pretty sure they filed for it. Yeah. And then also Topshop had to close a lot of its shops.
Yeah. So did American Apparel a couple of years ago.
Really? Yeah. So I think this whole kind of wave of fast fashion is slowing down.
If you've just tuned in, this is Climate Conversation on AAP Radio, brought to you by WRP. It's 9:40.
I mean, just the mass consumerism is absolutely wild.
I just find it insane how fast fashion now has so many rotating collections. Like, I don't know how many seasons I have in 1 year.
Oh,
I think
insane.
It's like 30, 40. And it's like, why do we need new stuff basically every week?
Yeah.
Like, we don't need that.
No. Absolutely not. But I think what's interesting is that, for example, I have some pieces of clothing that I've literally had for 15 years.
Yeah.
And they're still in incredible shape.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the time, obviously, when you purchase something, you're a little bit hesitant when you see the price tag. But, you know, 10 years later, I am so glad that I still have, you know, that one pair of shoes that still fits me and is still, and people are always like, oh my God, where did you get that? And I'm like, well, I got it 10 years ago and I don't know where. So.
Yeah. See, I think that's the beauty of thrifting as well, or just like buying from companies that are
good quality
because usually really good quality can be local, and it's really important to help local businesses because it helps into the economy, just like farmers. Like when you buy from local farmers, you're helping with the local economy, and also you're helping farmers right next door to you because so many times, actually this is happening in France right now and just yesterday, so many times we have big supermarkets that just try to find the cheapest prices and they get the cheapest potatoes, or they get the cheapest beets, or they get the cheapest peppers or whatever. I understand, like, if you need to import fruit from a different country.
Right, like mangoes.
Yeah, those make sense. But that being said, we really need to start, you know, shopping local with our food and also clothing and shoes, because they last so much longer and they're so much more unique.
And actually, what's really nice is I have a few friends who have begun a few initiatives, whether it be small independent grocery stores like BO stores or other clothing lines, where they really try to use local products or use local production to kind of, you know, to stay true to kind of the French identity and really produce within borders. And as we both agree, you know, mangoes and stuff can definitely be imported. But when, you know, you've got potatoes being grown, you know, 20 minutes outside of Paris, and then grocery stores like Carrefour buy potatoes from Spain, that's a little bit, I don't know.
Yeah. Whenever you have farmers that, you know, grow potatoes 20 minutes outside of Paris. But also, we need to touch up on urban sprawl for like 2 seconds. The leading cause of deforestation and soil degradation is urban sprawl, and because farms are right outside of urban cities, but because urban cities are getting so much bigger, we have to continue to move out. And I mean, just it's super detrimental to like the soil quality, which then is emitted into the atmosphere, because the degradation of soil means that there are more enzymes and micro microorganisms that decompose. And with that, then a lot of the carbon goes into the atmosphere because the soil is losing oxygen. So it's a super vicious cycle. And we need to understand that, like, literally everything in the environment, every organism and every ecosystem is super connected, which I think we tend to forget just because, like, they're so far away. But carbon and water and oxygen is all a big cycle in the environment. But so that'll be it for today. Thank you so much for being on here.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, that was Climate Conversation. This is Ivani signing off.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Serve the City Radio. I'm your host, Asa Cooper. Before I introduce our guest today, I'm going to explain a little bit about what Serve the City does for our first-time listeners. It's an international NGO that works to serve underprivileged communities around the world. Our parish branch specifically works with homeless populations through food distributions, as well as refugees and asylum seekers. We have a few different programs that help them get integrated into the city, such as language courses, professional networking, resume building, and things like that. But today we have a very special guest, Maria Pena, who is our marketing director here at Serve the City. She's also a Spanish visual artist who has led exhibitions and social impact art projects all around the world, including London, Beijing, Sao Paulo, New York, Haiti, and Bali. She's been the winner of various awards for her work, and she's here today to talk to us about her experience through these efforts. Hi, Maria.
Hello, Aita.
Thank you so much for coming on today. So you're unique because you have chosen to use art to kind of make a social impact and raise awareness about certain topics. How did you come about to doing this?
Yeah, well, it was a kind of natural decision. I always knew I wanted to study art, and I started painting and creating when I was a kid, and I just never stopped it. But at some point during my art career, I was feeling that I had the technique, but I had nothing to say. I had nothing important to say. I kind of lost my inspiration. So it was a kind of internal crisis, but that year it was very intense also, and in other works I was doing, I was very involved with nonprofit organizations, and one of these organizations was Oxfam, and they invited me to go to the climate change conference in Poznan, Poland, and they asked me to bring with me a huge painting about climate change, and that we will display there with other canvas from other artists from all around the world. Yeah, so I did it. I went with them to the conference, and then the last day at the protest, we displayed all that huge canvas, kind of creating a Chinese dragon, and it was so amazing how it worked. It was so powerful that I realized that art can be a great communication tool also. So I thought that I will find my inspiration there in the social and environmental challenges.
That's really cool. Mm-hmm. So it started with kind of a climate change focus.
Yeah.
And then how did you start to integrate your art into social purposes?
Yeah, then I came back and I wasn't sure how to start, how to do it. So I decided I will be teaching art for unprivileged communities. So yeah, I thought about how to do it, and I found a little NGO that was that had a project in Argentina. So I saved the money that year for going there in summer, and yeah, so I went with them. I was around 19 years old at the time, and it was the first time I was going alone so far, and it wasn't an easy trip. It was shocking how that adventure started, because I fly to Buenos Aires and then I had to travel by bus to the north of the country, to Formosa, And in that press, at midnight, we had a huge accident, and many people died that night. And so when I was able to continue my trip, I was thinking, just what the hell I'm doing here? I'm going to be completely useless, and I need help, and so I cannot help anybody. And yeah, I'm just teaching art, so yeah, that's not something really important. So that were my thoughts when I arrived there. But I arrived, and there the people, they were waiting for me, expecting me to start my art classes. So I just started, and next day, same thing, and next day, the same thing. And each night, the nightmares I had in the beginning started to disappear, and I had other things to think about. And I didn't have the time for being traumatized, and that people there, they were starting to really enjoy the classes. They like it to get their hands dirty and create and invent and imagine. So I understood that in the same way that classes were helping me, that classes were helping them to imagine other ways of living and thinking in the future. So after that, I kind of reinforced my idea about the potential of the art for social impact.
Okay. So your projects have kind of taken you all around the world, correct?
Yeah.
Is there a specific place or specific projects that you kind of want to take the opportunity to highlight here?
Yeah, maybe the one I developed in Brazil, in Sao Paulo. I was studying there with a scholarship, and I wanted to continue working in this direction. So I found an NGO working in a favela, and I went there and I introduced myself. And next week I was starting to develop a street art project with teenagers. We started talking about other artists that could connect with them. And then we started also designing our own art project. I taught them how to use the camera, the reflex camera I had, and we were taking photos of us, playing football, and having fun at their place, at the favela, no? And then we were choosing the best photos for reproduce them on a huge scale in some of the main walls of the favela, and we were also working with painting, and it was so cool. I really love it, and they were feeling very proud of their work, taking care of it. Even the neighbors were kind of involved. We were meeting a lot of times and talking about the future, about life, dancing samba, and again, that showed me how art can empower people, make them think different, and feel powerful for doing other things, and out of the easy way, not because being born and grow in a favela, it easily drives you to the drugs, and this can open your mind to other things.
That's really awesome. You kind of give people an avenue who maybe don't already have one, an opportunity to express themselves and be productive. So we were talking earlier about your most recent project, I believe, in Haiti, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So kind of like our last show where we talked about Chad, Haiti's one of the countries that you really hear about it on the news occasionally, but other than that, it's not a huge international focus. Mm-hmm. In such a kind of complex environment, is there really a place and interest for the arts?
Actually, I have never been in a place with so many artists.
Really?
Really, yeah. The streets of Port-au-Prince, which is the capital, are full of improvised street art galleries where the people is trying to sell their works. And there we worked with a group of artists who had created an studio in a little village in the north. And that place was like a refugee, like physical and mentally refuge. They were not thinking about the daily problems and living outside, like the extreme violence that they have in Haiti. So yeah, definitely I think that it's a country where art is very present, and creativity is also a need for problem solving.
Right. And again, kind of provides an outlet for people to, or like you said, a refuge where they can decompress, be creative, and not think about maybe stuff around them that isn't super easy.
Completely. It seems that you enter in another world when we were entering in that studio they had.
that's amazing that you're able to provide that outlet for them. And I believe you mentioned that you had spent some time in China as well, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was interested in that because it's such a vastly different culture than, mm-hmm. than the countries in the West. How did you go about establishing connections, getting people involved in a way that, you know, you felt could make a difference?
Yeah, it was mainly through emotions.
Really?
Yeah, and art has that capacity for breaking borders, no? And there are no limits for the art. So you can create a communication with people with whom you don't share a common language. And I was there in an art center, in an art museum. So there were many artists and yeah, they were like, they really wanted to communicate and we wanted to learn from each other. So yeah, we were using art for communication, let's say. So there I did two performances mainly, and one was at the Great Wall of China, and this one was something quite personal. I walked during 3 hours approximately through the Great Wall of China with high heels and with my eyes covered with scarves with different messages that represent for me like gender barriers that I have found in my life. So with that performance, I was metaphorically facing that barriers. And I was accompanied by two Chinese friends who were musicians, a violin and violinist and a cello. And the whole experience was really deep. I was feeling through sense like touch or like hearing that we are not usually using like so intensely. So next day when I saw the video of the performance, I thought that experience had nothing to do with what I had felt, no? So I decided to do something similar, but with the others, no? So involved in this experience. And I couldn't go to the Great Wall because the artists in China are considered like a subversive group. So yeah, because government know that the power of art actually. So instead of that, we went, I invited many people to come to the rooftop of the museum where I was, where they had the labyrinth that another artist did previously. And yeah, my friends, musicians, they also came. And yeah, I asked the people to write their borders in a scarf and cover their eyes with them and then go through the labyrinth following the music and touching the walls. And it was, again, so intense. Some people even cried for the emotions that they were feeling, and no one was expecting to feel all of that. And I have used more times this technique, and I always work very, very well. And always people is not expecting to feel that experience. So that's why, I mean, that's what I mean with art breaking borders.
Right. That's a really interesting way to go about doing it. I would have never thought of that. So you're involved with an art project, or you're kind of leading an art project right now through Serve the City as well. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm working now with Jack. Actually, Jack is also a member of Serve the City Paris leadership team, and he is a writer, and we are trying to transmit the stories of the refugees through art, no? So he is like writing their stories, and I'm creating illustrations and artworks inspired in that stories. But we are doing it also like in a participatory way, trying to involve the protagonist in the whole process. And yeah, and we want also to choose so not just the hard stories, also trying to show how brave they are, their dreams, and the great contribution that they can do to the European societies. So Asa, if you leave me, I'm gonna take advantage for doing a little
yes, of course
promotion because we are starting this project, so we need a little bit of support from. We want to do an art exhibition with this work and create a little book. So we are looking for galleries, for editorials, or for some kind of economical support too. So if someone would like to be part of this, I will leave my email, which is mapeco@gmail.com, mapeco@gmail.com.
All right. Well, yeah, if anyone is interested in participating, it sounds like an amazing opportunity to combine what France does best, art, with social impact. Yeah, feel free to reach out to Maria or us at Serve the City, and we can get in contact with her. Maria, thank you so much for coming on today and sharing thank your you. Work with us. And thank you for the work you do with Serve the City. And thank to our listeners, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Serve the City Paris. I'm your host, Asa Cooper, and we will see you next time.
AUP Radio is produced by Savannah Rowe, Fiona McMurray, Elise Chauvel, and Isabelle Guigui. That's me. Our theme music is by Jill Chavitz and Oliver Henry of Chateau Rouge. That's all for tonight on AUP Radio. Tune in tomorrow for more, and have a great night.